Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Wade Hudson, a member of the Iraq peace team who provides an eyewitness account of the U.S. bombardment and invasion of Iraq as seen during 31 days he spent in Baghdad. Steve Robinson, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, who discusses his organization's criticism of U.S. policy affecting veterans, stemming from the Pentagon's current operations. And Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute, who assesses the effect of the Iraq War and the Bush administration's proposed tax cuts on the U.S. economy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After months of controversy, the Bush administration's campaign to vaccinate hospital workers against smallpox ground to a halt in late March after two people died of heart attacks and severe reactions to the vaccine. For months, many hospitals had refused to allow public health workers to begin the vaccine because there was a very low risk of an outbreak, while the hazards of taking the vaccine were relatively high. In the end, only 29,000 people were vaccinated. According to The Nation magazine, the vaccination of emergency room doctors and nurses was the first step in preventing a bioterror outbreak of smallpox, a disease that was eradicated 26 years ago across the globe. Dr. Linda Rosenstock, dean of the UCLA School of Public Health, says the Bush administration has never divulged the real threat from a smallpox attack that could be launched by terrorists or a rogue state. Rosenstock concluded, they said there is nothing to worry about, while at the same time they recommended this extreme policy. Many medical professionals objected to the vaccination program because the threat of a bioterror smallpox attack is just a theoretical possibility, while the Bush administration is defunding public health programs to prevent and treat heart disease, cancer, AIDS, diabetes, and other life-threatening medical conditions. The Bush administration has been quietly settling lawsuits, many filed by industry groups, and is reshaping environmental policy to expand logging and other development. Critics have concluded that the White House is using these sue-and-settle tactics to skirt around congressional approval and public opinion. In Utah, the administration has declared its plans to remove wilderness protections from millions of acres of land. Protections currently in place for endangered species such as salmon and the northern spotted owl will also come under possible review. The administration has already lifted the Clinton-era ban on snowmobiles in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks and weakened logging regulations, with plans to allow increased commercial logging in California's Sierra Nevada range by the fall. Congress has already blocked the Bush initiative to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the Healthy Forests Initiative, which would increase logging allegedly to reduce the risk of forest fires. Patty Goldman of Earth Justice concluded, under the guise of settling lawsuits, federal officials have retired to the back rooms to work out deals that sacrifice our old-growth forests, salmon, and clean water for the sake of clear-cutting our public lands. In the weeks following the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska's pristine Prince William Sound, brothers Mike, Roger, and Paul Potter scrambled over oil-drenched rocks trying to save the sludge-drenched wildlife as part of the cleanup crew. Cleanup workers almost immediately experienced health problems and flu-like symptoms as a result of being exposed to what was dubbed Valdez crud. According to Mother Jones magazine, crude oil contains benzene and other hazardous agents that may cause cancer. In addition, Inapol, the compound used to remove oil from rocks and beaches, is known to cause rashes, respiratory ailments, and can damage the liver and kidneys. By the end of 1989, over 1,800 cleanup workers had filed for workers' compensation, and investigators from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health traveled to Prince William Sound to look into complaints, but Exxon refused to provide access to medical records. The oil giant has settled 7 cases with cleanup workers and sealed the record of the one case that went to trial. Pamela Miller of the group Alaska Community Action on Toxics has tried to track down former cleanup workers for inclusion in future legal actions. As she observed, the oil companies know the dangers of this stuff. Nobody provided workers with any protection. It will happen all over again. This week's news summary was compiled by Britta Brundage and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. We'll be right back.
as stage-managed media images of the Bush administration's triumphant conquest of Iraq fade into memory, the harsh reality of American occupation is becoming clearer with each passing day. The goodwill expressed towards U.S. troops by some Iraqi citizens, thankful for the overthrow of a brutal dictator, has given way to increasingly vocal demands for sovereignty and self-determination. Street protests organized by diverse sectors of Iraq's religious and ethnic communities have condemned both the fallen regime of Saddam Hussein and the American military which now occupies their nation. Retired General Jay Garner, the man appointed by the Bush administration to rule post-war Iraq, has been the target of criticism by many Iraqis for America's failure to prevent the looting of hospitals, museums, and libraries, and the restoration of essential services such as water and electricity destroyed by U.S. bombs during the conflict. Even as thousands of Iraqi civilians suffer from injuries and privation caused by the war, the Pentagon has prevented dozens of non-governmental relief organizations from entering Iraq because they refused to shed their neutrality and submit to military control. The Bush administration has similarly blocked a role for the United Nations in relief assistance and the re-entry of UN inspectors to resume their hunt for chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, the one-time justification for this illegal U.S. war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wade Hudson, a member of the Iraq peace team affiliated with the group Voices in the Wilderness. Hudson, an activist, writer, and cab driver, provides an eyewitness account of the U.S. bombardment and invasion of Iraq as seen during 31 days he spent in Baghdad before his departure on April 13th.
Well, as soon as the bombing started, our primary project was to gather evidence about the damage to civilian infrastructure and the civilian casualties, the injuries and the deaths that were being inflicted by the bombing. And we compiled that information into a report, which we issued on April 4th. Well, myself, the first day of bombing, I had a tour that involved looking at a number of buildings that were hit, and it was hard to know exactly what those buildings were. And we ended up in a residential neighborhood where there was clearly no government buildings or military targets anywhere near. And whenever you drop a million tons of bombs on a country, and a large portion of which in a densely populated city like Baghdad, it's inevitable that a large percentage of those bombs are going to kill civilians and injure them severely and destroy residential and commercial houses. I was sitting on the balcony of our hotel when the Palestine Hotel was hit that became highly publicized because it was home for the media that were in Baghdad. And I looked over my shoulder and saw a cloud of smoke, and a few minutes later the fire inside the hotel room where two journalists died, one of whom worked with a Spanish TV station that had been sending emails out of Baghdad for us. So, that added a certain poignancy to the incident and made us feel a little bit less secure, under the shadow of the Palestine Hotel.
The Bush administration, in justifying the war against the regime of Saddam Hussein, stated over and over again that the price of civilian casualties in this war, that we still don't know the exact numbers, will be worth it in the end because a despotic government will be removed. How did the people of Iraq that you had contact with during the war see this conflict? Did they think it was justified?
Well, it's hard to generalize about the Iraqi people, partly because they did live under a very oppressive dictatorship and they were not free to speak their minds. And, there are no reliable public opinion polls. I must say that I think that, regardless of any benefits that might accrue, that, this war was inherently immoral and illegal and could never be justified. I mean, Iraq did not threaten the United States, and we have a whole legacy of international law that stipulates that nations do not invade and attack other nations, unless they are threatened. But back to your question, I think that, there was a 24 hours or 36 hours of relief and some joy about having Saddam toppled. I think most Iraqis probably had some positive feelings about that. But you know, it was not overwhelming ecstasy. You know, there were just a number of indications that suggest to me that large numbers of Iraqis never wanted the United States to attack. I mean, before the bombing started, we would circulate in the open-air markets and go to shops and, you know, go shopping, and people would find out who we were and why we were there, and there would just be spontaneous expressions of gratitude and appreciation. And if so many people had wanted to be liberated by the United States, we would not have been swamped with people coming up to us like that spontaneously. If there was a liberation honeymoon, it was over and done with awful quickly. And the Iraqi people most likely want the United States to be done with it and out of there. And the irony is that, you know, the Bush administration talks about wanting democracy, but when the people of Turkey say, you know, no to U.S. troops, we try to bribe their government.
Wade Hudson, what are some of your big concerns about the U.S. occupation of Iraq and any kind of transition to an interim government, which may or may not be led by Iraqi exiles, many of whom haven't set foot in the country in decades?
Right. I mean, it seems like the U.S. is just fumbling along. I can't imagine what their real intent is other than to allow the country to fall into a very long period of disorder and strife. They say that the Iraqi oil belongs to the Iraqi people, but it will be interesting to see how they try to spin that one when they privatize the oil companies, which seems to be the plan. Iraq is filled with so many different factions that are ready to tear into one another. And the more disorder there is, the more people will identify with their own grouping as a defense mechanism, and the more likely they will strike out against others. So I think the United States has bitten off more than it can chew. It's like they were bothered by some hornets, and they went out and whacked at the hornet's nest, and now they're trying to get rid of the hornets with a fly swatter, and they've created an incredible mess, and we cannot rely on the United States to clean it up. We need to defer to the United Nations. So now we're in a situation where the Iraqi people could very well go the direction of Iran, and I seriously doubt that the Bush administration would accept that.
That was Wade Hudson, a member of the Iraq peace team organized by the group Voices in the Wilderness. The group can be contacted by calling area code 773-784-8065 or visit their website at www.iraqpeaceteam.org. While the Bush administration claims victory in the war on Iraq and praises the role of American soldiers there, advocates for those same military men and women stationed in the Gulf region have been critical of some U.S. policies affecting the troops. One issue of concern is the continued use of depleted uranium, or DU, ammunition, despite research indicating harmful health effects on both soldiers and civilians from its use in the first Gulf War and elsewhere. They also criticized President Bush's proposed 2004 budget, which cut funding to the Veterans Administration. Finally, they object to the Pentagon's ignoring a 1998 law that requires the collection of pre- and post-deployment health records on troops sent overseas. The law was enacted to facilitate tracking of toxic exposures, a procedure not carried out in the first Gulf War, when tens of thousands of returning troops contracted a variety of ailments known as Gulf War Syndrome. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Steve Robinson, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center, based outside Washington, D.C. The center's mission is to protect soldiers before, during, and after war. He addresses his organization's concerns stemming from the Pentagon's current operations in Iraq.
I think the biggest problem would be that the public law is designed to protect them in terms of collecting baseline health data before they deploy, and collecting actual physical blood samples from them when they return is not going to be done. We've already missed the opportunity to collect the pre-deployment data, and it appears as if they're not going to collect the post-deployment data.
And is that true for across the board? Did any service members have that done before they deployed?
It's pretty much true across the board. Rather than doing hands-on physicals to establish the baseline for pre-deployment, they hand out a questionnaire and they say, do you feel healthy? Do you have any medical problems that you need to report? Do you have 90 days worth of pills? If you take any, do you wear glasses? And that's how they establish whether people were healthy before they deployed. In the post-deployment phase, they do much the same thing. They hand them a questionnaire. You got to imagine now, you're coming out of Iraq, and you're getting ready to get on a plane to come back, and you get an 8-question questionnaire that says, are you healthy? Do you have anything you want to declare before you get on the plane? There's significant questions about whether or not the way they're interpreting the law is going to develop any meaningful data when soldiers return.
What can be done at this point to try to be able to follow exposures of people who are over there and minimize the kinds of difficulties that people experienced in the first Gulf War?
On March 25th of this year, we had 2 hearings. So it's on the record now. It won't be a 12-year gap in identifying that they didn't do their job. Secondly, we will begin to form a coalition of the willing to force DOD to comply with the public laws. And we'll do that by going to Congress, speaking with representatives and senators who understand that this law is important and that when they wrote it into the books that they intended for it to be done. And now what can they do to make sure it does happen?
Are there particular members of Congress, representatives or senators, who are already cooperating in this, from whom you feel you get support?
Yeah, there is, and those senators and congressmen, they would range from Senators Clinton, Kerry, Feinstein, Feingold, to Congressmen Shays, Evans, and others who are concerned about the impact that not following the public law will produce.
In the budget proposal that President Bush sent to Congress a couple of weeks ago, there were cuts in a lot of places, and there was also a cut in veterans' benefits. Some or all of that money was put back in by Congress. Can you speak to that and fill in those details a little bit?
Yeah, there was an attempt to cut 1% in every department across the entire spectrum of federal spending, and that slice of that pie for veterans was $28 billion. In the Department of Veterans Affairs. Someone must not have been thinking on their feet to propose such a thing in a time when soldiers were losing their lives on the battlefield. But at any rate, the Veterans Service Organizations got wind of it and began to march in the halls of the Cannon and the Rayburn office building and say, what are you doing? And Congress took notice and realized that it was a bad idea to cut funding from the VA in a time that we were in war, when increased demand is going to happen when soldiers return.
That whole amount, as of now, has been put back?
Correct.
Is troops exposure to DU, as well as obviously Iraqi exposure to DU, is that a major concern? Is that happening to a large degree in this war?
But number one, it is happening, and number two, it is a concern. There are 2 sides to this issue. One side is the Iraqi propaganda side, which says depleted uranium is causing all of the health impacts that are happening in Iraq. And then the other opposite end of that coin is the DOD side, which says depleted uranium is safe and effective and you can, you know, spread it on your breakfast cereal. In the middle is the truth, where the science lies. And the science says that exposure to depleted uranium in the oxide form can cause long-term health effects. It can cause cancers. And it also says that depleted uranium, when spread out over the battlefield, can seep into the groundwater and into the food systems where people live and eat. So it is a concern. The World Health Organization is investigating depleted uranium in places like Kosovo and Bosnia right now. They've tried to get into Iraq. They want to look into Iraq and see what's going on there. So we continue to be cautiously skeptical of both sides of the coin that want to use this for a political gain and try to focus on the science. And the science says it's still a danger and it needs to be investigated.
That was Steve Robinson of the National Gulf War Resource Center. Call the center at 1-800-882-1316, extension 162, or visit their website at www.ngwrc.org. Although public attention has been focused on America's war in Iraq in recent months, the sad state of the U.S. economy is a major issue looming on the political horizon. But even as President Bush celebrates his victory in ousting Saddam Hussein's regime in Baghdad, America's occupation and plans for reconstruction of oil-rich Iraq will likely do little to reverse the loss of jobs and economic downturn here at home. Due to the continuing poor performance of the U.S. economy and resistance from Republican Party moderates, the White House was forced to scale back its $726 billion tax cut proposal to a $550 billion tax break, benefiting mostly the rich. But opponents in the Senate are working to limit any tax cut to $350 billion. Before the war, 10 Nobel laureates, supported by more than 450 economists from across the country, condemned the Bush tax cut plan, warning that the measure would do little to create jobs and generate further income inequality. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lawrence Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, who explains the likely impact of the Iraq war on the U.S. economy and why he opposes the Bush drive for billions of dollars in new tax cuts.
Well, going into the war, there was a lot of uncertainty. We didn't know whether it's going to be long and expensive. We didn't know whether there's going to be damage to the oil wells and whether the oil price was going to rise extraordinarily. But all those questions are now really behind us. We know it was of short duration, relatively minor costs as wars would go, and we didn't have the problem with the oil prices. So in the end, I think the war will not have a major effect on the economy. There are some who have said that people were not spending because of uncertainty about the war, that business weren't investing in hiring, but that is no longer the case, and so we will actually be able to see very shortly whether hiring and investment will pick up. I mean, there are a lot of people that have asked me questions about, can we afford the war? And I think the appropriate way to think about it is that, we are a very wealthy country. We can easily afford this war. It's just a matter of what taxes we're willing to pay and what priorities we're willing to set. It's also the case that we can easily afford, I think, to provide health insurance for every child. So it's less about economic choices than about political choices and legislative choices.
I wanted to turn our attention to the Bush administration's proposed tax cuts. The White House started out with a proposal that there should be $726 billion in tax cuts. Mr. Bush scaled that back somewhat to $550 billion tax cut proposal now. What are the important elements of the debate about the Bush tax cuts that we should all be thinking about as citizens during a time of a fiscal crisis? Certainly there are many cutbacks across the board, especially at the state level and at the federal level, but yet the White House is going full speed ahead with billions of dollars in tax cuts, primarily to the wealthiest sector in this country.
Well, I think there's three different dimensions of this debate that people ought to consider. One is whether the tax cuts as proposed by the administration are going to be appropriate policy for generating jobs and economic growth this year or in the long run, as they claim. Secondly, whether taking revenue and giving it in tax cuts is the best priorities that the nation has. Other priorities might include a good prescription drug benefit, providing rebuilding schools, providing health insurance to children, other matters like that. And a third dimension of this is just distributional equity. We have seen a dramatic surge in income inequality in this country over the last 20, 25 years. We have the most inequality we've had ever in our society. We have much more income inequality than other advanced countries. So whether you want to use the tax cut to actually exacerbate inequality is really something that people ought to debate. Because one of the underlying elements of Bush's tax proposal, in fact, a dramatic radical change in in taxation, which speaks to the following. Taxes should not be paid on income that is earned from owning things, assets like capital gains or dividends or stock. And therefore, taxes should only be paid by people who earn wage income. I mean, this is not, I'm not talking about a conspiracy. The administration is quite forthright, and its economists quite forthright, that this is a move towards that kind of system, which is basically wage taxation only.
If the Bush administration does eke out this tax cut, what kind of effect do you think that will have on average citizens in terms of social spending, programs that people look toward in tough economic times? Do you think people will feel this in their pocketbook in the coming months and years?
Well, I think people are going to feel the effect of several things. One is the extreme fiscal crises in state and local government. And I think voters don't differentiate so much who's responsible for the loss of services that they will experience. They don't know whether it's the mayor, the governor, or the president, or the senator. And so to the extent that the administration does not provide fiscal relief to the states to help states get through this crisis, I think there'll be a penalty to pay. I think there's actual programs that are going to be cut. We've already seen that the budget this year is going to cut environmental programs, Department of Justice programs, training programs. We know that they're underfunding the education programs relative to what was promised in President Bush's own preferred legislation and Leave No Child Behind. So there's going to be a loss of an actual cut in many programs, and the government is going to have less money to address needs that people have. So that definitely will be a problem. If the tax cut is configured as the president wants, with a big part of it going for removing the taxes on dividends, I think it'll have a very negligible effect, positive effect on the economy in the short run, and in the long run it'll be negative. So I think most people won't benefit directly from the dividend exclusion. I mean, a typical middle-class family will gain around $28.
That was Lawrence Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epinet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.